attempting to vote. They said these men who were in prison and came out that they can register, and if they qualify, because they didn't know if they did because they had served time in jail, they will be allowed to vote. And then they were handcuffed and arrested for voting. Your response?
Well, they were handcuffed and arrested for voting while they had in their hands their voting cards. Now, if you're sent a voting card by your county register, wouldn't you assume that that means you have the right to vote? So the fact that DeSantis, people here call him DeSatan, has decided that he wants to use the and play the race card by having mostly black, look at who he's arresting. It's not just, whites, because more whites have been affected by these felony disenfranchisement laws than blacks, but he's mainly arresting black people, that he's playing the race card because he wants to be president. Doesn't that say something ill about the concept of our democracy, the concept of who we are, that we want a person who is using race? Because it worked before, right, with Trump. So they're saying, okay, we'll do it again.
We have to leave it there, but I want to thank you so much for being with us. Barbara Arnwine, civil rights lawyer with Transformative Justice Coalition, and Kimberly Crenshaw, executive director of the African American Policy Forum and professor of law at UCLA and Columbia University, speaking to us from Jekyll Island, Georgia. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much.
Destination set. Planning route two. Two. Hackney Downs Station. Hackney. London.
You're tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
The KBOO Evening News produces a nightly one-hour newscast every weekday night. We need writers, editors, reporters, and more to make this grassroots community resource happen. Are you interested? Would you like to try something exciting? Training in writing for radio, interviewing, field recording, and audio editing is all free of charge. But you have to go through the KBOO volunteer orientation first. For more information, email newsdirector@kboo.org.
Join KBOO every Friday at 5:30 p.m. for Counterspin, a show that provides a critical examination of major media stories and exposes what the mainstream media missed. Counterspin exposes and highlights censored stories, sexism, racism, and homophobia in the news, the power of corporate influence, gaffes and goofs by leading TV pundits, and more. That's every Friday at 5:30 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland City Council candidate Rene Gonzalez faces another campaign finance violation fine. A second Portland area New Seasons votes to unionize. And 50 years since the Clean Water Act was passed, its future in the hands of the Supreme Court now. We take a look back. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, October 21st, 2022. I'm Eric Leuschner. Portland City Commissioner candidate Rene Gonzalez is facing another fine from the city for his campaign finance violations. Earlier in the general election, the Small Donor Elections Office fined Gonzalez $77,000 for accepting and not disclosing an illegal kind of contribution. Gonzalez accepted office space in downtown Portland at a 96% discount from Portland real estate billionaire Jordan Schnitzer. Now he's being fined an additional $5,520 by the city auditor's office for accepting two parking spaces from Schnitzer at no cost. The value of the parking spaces was about $460 a month. The city auditor's office calculated the fine to be double the value of the parking spots. The letter from the city auditor's office clarifies that campaigns can take discounts, but only ones that are available to the general public. The discount from Schnitzer was unique to the Gonzalez campaign, so it is not permitted. Gonzalez is challenging Joanne Hardesty in the general election. He has yet to pay his five-figure fine to the Small Donors Election Office. Workers at the slab town New Seasons voted to unionize with the New Seasons Labor Union. They're the second local New Seasons store to unionize, bringing union membership up to 230. Workers said they wanted to push for better wages, a better work environment, and input on staff training. New Seasons has the option to recognize the staff union without requiring a National Labor Relations Board election. Instead, the grocery company has opted to engage in union busting, hiring a law firm known for that type of action. At union elections at two New Seasons locations, Selwood and Hillsboro, the vote failed to get enough support. Three other locations, Grant Park, Woodstock, and Concordia, are still awaiting their union election. Two people were arrested for burglarizing a home in Camas that was in the evacuation zone for the Nakia Creek fire. Early Thursday, homeowners called police after seeing two people enter their house on their home security cameras. Officers responded, finding a car at the scene that contained items from inside the house. Both suspects fled, but one was arrested after a chase, and the other some hours later, after needing an ambulance for an unknown medical issue. Both suspects face charges of residential burglary and second-degree theft. Mike Pence speaks out on the January 6 attacks, and Liz Truss resigns as Prime Minister of Great Britain. With those stories and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I will tell you that when we reconvene the United States Senate, I thank the members in both political parties for staying at their post, coming back to work, and completing the peaceful transfer of power.
Former Vice President Mike Pence spoke to students at Georgetown University about the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. With former President Donald Trump seeking a potential run in 2024, Pence has spoken out about the dangers of the assault on the Capitol. This comes a week after the Select Committee investigating those attacks announced they will be seeking Trump's testimony. New evidence aired at the hearing reveals the former president knew what kind of violence would occur. The Environmental Protection Agency is celebrating 50 years of the Clean Water Act, first passed in 1972. At a press conference in Cleveland, EPA Administrator Michael Regan discussed how the Cuyahoga was one of many rivers to serve as a catalyst for this legislation.
Like too many waterways across our country in the 1950s and 60s, the Cuyahoga River had fallen victim to years of unchecked pollution. I'm talking about the days when our rivers were treated as nothing more than dumping grounds.
British Prime Minister Liz Truss resigned after 44 days in office. This comes after a proposed tax-cutting budget rocked financial markets in the UK.
We set out a vision for a low-tax, high-growth economy that would take advantage of the freedoms of Brexit. I recognise, though, given the situation, I cannot deliver the mandate on which I was elected.
While speaking among numerous local and congressional leaders in Pennsylvania about new infrastructure projects, President Joe Biden spoke about Republicans changing views of the Build Back Better infrastructure bill.
Let's get something straight. We managed to get some Republicans to vote for this, 13 in the House and 19 in the Senate, and I'm truly grateful for them. I mean it sincerely. But a whole lot more voted against it, but are taking credit for it now.
In the debate for governor of Oklahoma, candidate Joy Hoffmeister described some of the issues people will be considering when voting in the November midterm elections.
Education is on the ballot. Our rural communities are on the ballot. Freedom is on the ballot to make decisions for yourself and your trusted doctor.
This coming Saturday marks 10 years since Superstorm Sandy devastated the East Coast. Although cities hit by the storm have rebuilt damaged infrastructure in the decades since then, as storms increase in magnitude, it remains to be seen how effective this will be against climate change's growing impacts. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The Clean Water Act marks its 50th anniversary this week, and while it has had many successes, the U.S. Supreme Court could soon limit the water bodies it protects. Mary Sherman has more on the story.
The 1969 Cuyahoga River fire spurred the passage of the Clean Water Act in Congress. And this week, the landmark legislation marks 50 years of transforming the waterways across the country. A new National Wildlife Federation report finds the number of places that meet water quality standards has nearly doubled in the past 50 years, thanks to Clean Water Act provisions that help limit pollution, prosecute polluters, and fund restoration efforts. Shantae Coleman with the National Wildlife Federation says the Cuyahoga River is a poster child for the importance of the law.
This is not the first time that this river went up into flames due to industrial and sewage waste. And today, due to the Clean Water Act, you can actually eat fish from the river. It's a really incredible story. The benefits from the Cuyahoga River could be seen just a mere 20 years later.
Coleman says despite success of the law, parts of it are currently under attack in a case before the U.S. Supreme Court. It could remove protections from some streams and wetlands, which would then make it easier and cheaper to pollute or even eliminate these waterways. According to the report, the Clean Water Act regulates nearly 200,000 point source polluters, like sewage treatment facilities, petroleum refineries, and indoor hog farms. And Coleman notes it keeps 700 billion pounds of pollutants out of the nation's water each year.
Levels of metals like lead in our rivers have declined dramatically, and ultimately the cost to clean our drinking water is lower because our entire system is healthier, and clean drinking water benefits all communities, but especially most vulnerable communities that face increased polluted water due to climate change.
Coleman notes the benefits of the Clean Water Act are still not equally distributed. However, especially for urban and low-income communities and communities of color.
There's way too many Americans from these demographics that remain vulnerable to water pollution. So the law really does need some fine-tuning so that access to clean water doesn't depend on your race, zip code, or your income.
Those improvements, she says, could include investing in water infrastructure in vulnerable communities. The report also makes the case for Congress to do more to address agricultural runoff, which is the leading reason bodies of water across the U.S. don't meet water quality standards. For Ohio News Connection, I'm Mary Sherman.
Prior to passage of the 1972 Clean Water Act, post-war industrialization was taking a real toll on waterways because they weren't legally protected. Now, as its 50th anniversary is celebrated, those protections are under threat. About 200,000, quote, point source polluters, sewage treatment facilities, paper mills, petroleum refineries, indoor hog farms, and more, are currently regulated under the law. Roz Brown has more.
50 years ago this week, Congress passed the Clean Water Act, allowing policymakers in the 50 states to limit pollution, prosecute polluters, and fund clean water restoration efforts. Now it's in jeopardy. Backers of the Clean Water Act fear the health of about half the nation's streams and wetlands are at risk as the Supreme Court weighs a case that could curtail the long-standing protections. Amanda Fuller, with the National Wildlife Federation in Texas, says a 1972 law passed with bipartisan support, likely in direct response to the post-war proliferation of untreated sewage and industrial discharge in waterways across the country.
If folks recall, images of rivers on fire was quite alarming, and I think it was just a moment of reckoning for the nation.
The case under consideration by the Supreme Court, Sackett versus the EPA, would weaken the agency's ability to safeguard water quality. During the initial hearing earlier this month, several conservative court justices expressed concern about the law's broad reach. Fuller says ephemeral streams, those that flow only when it rains, account for about 80% of all streams in the West.
And that comes out to 2,183 streams in Texas that essentially are at risk of losing protection from the Clean Water Act if the Supreme Court rules in favor of the Sacketts.
Fuller cites a poll by Morning Consult that shows 75% of adults want more waterways protected, and 4 in 5 want the Environmental Protection Agency, rather than Congress, state, or local governments, to continue taking the lead in protecting clean water. For Texas News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be rainy with an overnight low of 45. Air quality has improved significantly in the Portland metro area. However, air quality warnings are in place for Deschutes County and Eastern Lane County. Tomorrow's weather will also be rainy with a high of 57 degrees. Today in history, in 1945, French women are allowed to vote for the very first time. The quote of the day is from American novelist and longtime Portlander Ursula K. Le Guin, who was born today in 1929. Le Guin said, quote, "As great scientists have said, and as all children know, it is above all by the imagination that we achieve perception and compassion and hope." Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin issued an order saying the Pentagon will help troops and their dependents get abortions if they're stationed in states where the procedures are illegal. Austin committed to providing travel funds and support for troops and their dependents who seek abortions but are stationed in states where they are now illegal. Access to abortion has become significantly limited in a number of states after the Supreme Court reversed Roe v. Wade and took away the constitutional right to the procedure in the Dobbs v. Jackson ruling in June. More than a dozen states have banned or restricted abortions since. The new military policy set guidelines preventing local commanders from influencing whether service members get access to care. It also intends to minimize repercussions for those wanting abortions. The Pentagon already announced in June, days after the Supreme Court decision, that it would continue to allow medical leave for service members who needed to travel out of state to get abortions. However, it also said it needed to review the court ruling and subsequent state laws to see if additional guidance would be necessary. The Pentagon has been concerned that the Dobbs ruling could affect recruitment and retention because service members or potential recruits might be concerned they would be assigned to states where abortions are illegal. A number of major military bases are located in states where anti-abortion laws are now in place, particularly Texas and Florida. The new guidelines also direct each military base to publicly display what reproductive health care support is available for service members and their dependents, to extend the time in which service members must report a pregnancy to commanders to 20 weeks, and to provide some additional protections for defense health care personnel who provide abortion services. Under federal law, the Pentagon's health care system can provide abortions only in cases of rape or incest, or when the mother's life is in danger. That doesn't change under the new policy. The funds the military would provide cover transportation only. They would not pay for any abortion services that are not covered by federal law. The new policy should be implemented by the end of the year. Among female voters ages 18 to 29 in the battleground states, new polling shows abortion and women's rights are the most important and highly motivating issues in determining their vote. Mary Sherman has the story.
In this election cycle, a new poll indicates women's voices matter more than ever. Polling in Ohio and eight other battleground states by Lake Research Partners found that abortion and equal rights are top drivers for women who plan to vote. Kathy Spiller is executive editor of Ms. Magazine, which released the poll along with Feminist Majority Foundation. She says it found 41% of young women voters are feeling angry or worried about the Supreme Court's decision overturning Roe v. Wade.
Overturning abortion rights has lit a fire under women in the battleground states, especially young women. And in fact, women who are for abortion rights are far more energized in this election around this issue than those who oppose abortion.
Spiller says this refutes past trends of abortion opponents being more motivated by the issue. While Ohio does not track voter registrations by gender, a New York Times report found the percentage of newly registered female Ohio voters rose following the Dobbs decision from 47% to 54%. Spiller says the polling also reveals that young women voters understand they don't have the equal rights guaranteed in the U.S. Constitution.
They are saying that it's more important than ever now that the Equal Rights Amendment be added to the Constitution to guarantee there can't be discrimination on the basis of sex. Three-quarters of all women likely voters in the battleground states make that connection.
And Spiller notes because women account for half of voters, the issues they care about could impact the outcome of elections and which party has the majority in Congress.
This election is much more than about inflation or crime or any of the other issues that we keep hearing about. Women's lives, our rights, access to abortion and birth control is top of mind for women voters in these battleground states.
55% of young women voters ranked abortion and women's rights the most important issues determining their vote in the elections. Just one-third of young women voters ranked inflation and rising prices as their top issues motivating their vote, a difference of 22 points. And only 9% ranked climate change and 5% for education debt. This story was produced with original reporting from Roxy Saar for Ms. Magazine. For Ohio News Connection, I'm Mary Sherman.
Anti-Asian hate crimes have almost tripled in New York State since the pandemic began. One advocacy group suggests curbing the violence will require giving the issues the same attention and funding as any public health crisis. Edwin J. Vieira has more on the story.
As Asian Americans continue to face discrimination and hate crimes, new funding could aid New York officials in reporting and preventing these incidents. The multipurpose funding from the Bureau of Justice Assistance will be used to create grants to help community groups in New York City educate people about Asian American culture. The hope is to alleviate some of the tension that has grown since former President Donald Trump dubbed COVID-19 the China virus. Kalea Ann Mendoza with the group Nonviolent Peace Force says Asian Americans need time to process what has gone on.
We haven't had a chance to pause. We haven't had a chance to heal. I think we are constantly put into a state of hypervigilance. I think that there needs to be dedicated spaces for us in our communities to be able to recognize the trauma that we have experienced.
He hopes people can work to create a safer and more equitable world and says this mindset needs to be part of the immediate response to the violence. According to Stop AAPI Hate, over 11,000 hate crimes have been reported in the last 2 years. On a state level, Mendoza says he'd like to see this dealt with as a public health issue, with more resources for developing holistic public safety practices for Asian Americans. On a federal level, his organization wants to see more cooperation between local and national advocacy groups and a more robust dialogue on how to keep people safe.
It's important for us to be able to listen to what the direct needs around safety are and to be able to tailor and support and provide the resources, whether that's through trainings, whether that's through advisement or supporting the safety infrastructure.
Until people are better able to address the root causes of racism, Mendoza is worried that little change will occur. But Congress passed the COVID-19 Hate Crimes Act last year to expedite the review of hate crimes and hate crime reports. I'm Edwin J. Vieira, New York News Connection.
The Rapid City, South Dakota hotel owners who are accused of racially discriminating against Native Americans face a lawsuit from the Department of Justice. With that story and more, it's Daniel Montano with National Native News.
For National Native News, I'm Daniel Montano in for Antonia Gonzalez.
The U.S. Justice Department is filing a lawsuit against Rapid City hotel owners accused of denying service to Native Americans. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Lee Strubinger has more.
Federal prosecutors accuse owners of the Grand Gateway Hotel and Cheers Sports Lounge of devising and implementing racially discriminatory policies this spring. One of the hotel owners posted on Facebook that natives were no longer allowed at the hotel and bar following an overnight shooting in their building in March. Days after, Native Americans tried booking rooms at the hotel twice and were allegedly denied service. Kristen Clark is the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights at the DOJ.
Policies that prohibit Native Americans from accessing public places are patently offensive, racially discriminatory, and have no place in our society today.
The Department of Justice says the owners violated Title II of the Civil Rights Act. Nick Tilson is the CEO of NDN Collective, an indigenous rights organization. They filed an initial lawsuit against the hotel saying they were denied service. Tilson calls the move by the Justice Department significant. However, Tilson says it's up to the community to tackle the issue of racism in Rapid City.
If it wasn't for us marching in the streets, and if it wasn't for us speaking truth to power, if it wasn't for us having the courage to walk into Grand Gateway and get denied, if it wasn't for the courage of us filing a lawsuit, Department of Justice wouldn't be doing this today.
Defendants Nick and Connie Urey did not respond to requests for comment. For National Native News, I'm Lee Strubinger in Rapid City.
U.S. Representative Mary Peltola was greeted with exuberant applause and a standing ovation at the Alaska Federation of Natives annual convention, where she delivered the keynote address Thursday. She spoke to the convention's theme of unity, although she deplored the pervasive political climate she said is filled with negative messages that inspire fear, distress, and worry.
They're destructive. They're acidic. They tear us down. There is no place for hate and fear and self-pity if we're going to survive and thrive and overcome our challenges.
Peltola, who is Yupik, peppered her speech with personal asides and memories. She took the time to recognize the family of longtime Representative Don Young, who were in attendance. Young died in March, and Peltola won the special election to fill out his term, and she's on the November ballot to fill the seat for the next 2 years. The AFN gathering in Anchorage is the first fully in-person convention since the start of the COVID pandemic. A rare white buffalo mounted at the Montana Historical Society will be returned to the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes. MTPR's Aaron Bolton reports a ceremony was held Thursday to acknowledge the move.
Big Medicine was born on the Flathead Reservation in the 1930s. He was not considered albino as he had a brown tuft of fur between his horns, but the slim odds of the local herd producing a white buffalo made him sacred to the Salish, Kootenai, and other tribes. When Big Medicine died, he was mounted and eventually displayed at the Montana Historical Society in Helena. The CSKT formally asked for his return this summer, with plans to bring him back to the National Bison Range on the reservation where he once lived. The Historical Society's board voted unanimously to grant that request. CSKT Tribal Chairman Tom McDonald spoke in a ceremony shortly after the vote.
It's a revitalization. His return will be very significant for us. Can't be overstated how important today is.
The Historical Society plans to hold on to Big Medicine until the CSKT builds a facility on the Bison Range where he can be displayed. For National Native News, I'm Aaron Bolton.
And I'm Daniel Montano.
Cryptocurrencies use more electricity in a year than Norway, but the industry could cause less harm by adopting processes that use less computing power and by switching to renewable energy sources. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Cryptocurrencies such as Bitcoin have no physical form. You cannot hold them in your hand like a dollar bill, but they have a real impact on the climate. That's because the most common process used to validate cryptocurrency transactions and to bring new cryptocurrency into circulation requires a huge amount of computing power. And all that computing takes a lot of electricity. In the case of Bitcoin, as much as a country.
We're talking 110, 120, 130 terawatt hours. That's like in the ballpark of Norway, what they would use in a single year.
That's Benjamin Jones, an associate professor at the University of New Mexico. He says much of that electricity comes from fossil fuels, so it creates carbon pollution.
But there's also solutions that are readily available for us to solve this as well.
He says cryptocurrency companies can use processes that require far less computing power. Ethereum, the world's second largest cryptocurrency, is adopting a method that the company expects will cut electricity use by 99%. And the industry can rely more on clean, renewable energy. So Jones says it's possible to have cryptocurrency without so much environmental harm. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, October 21st, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, the producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Edwin J. Vieira, Daniel Montaño, Mary Sherman, Roz Brown, and Dr. Anthony Leisowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support your local community radio station, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Counterspin.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience. KBOO, Portland.